Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Have you ever found yourself trapped in a situation you couldn't seem to escape? In this video lecture, Why Did I Stay?, I explore the complex psychology behind staying in systems of control. As a therapist and cult specialist, I reveal a profound truth. People don't stay in abusive relationships because they want to. They stay because they're conditioned to, or they're too afraid to leave. This lecture delves deep into the psychology traps that make leaving so difficult, whether it affects your clients, your friends, or if this is even for yourself. If you've ever questioned, why did I stay, or questioned other people in that same way, why did you stay? This comprehensive exploration of manipulation will help you understand the invisible chains that keep people bound to controlling systems. This lecture and many more are available for purchase on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. Just follow the link in the description of this episode to view and purchase all of the available lecture videos. Take good care. Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Michelle Dowd. She is the author of Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult, a memoir about growing up on a mountain inside an apocalyptic cult and reclaiming her life through wildness, beauty, and self-trust. Her work lives at the intersection of sensual truth, sacred rebellion, and creative fire, and has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Alpinist, and other national publications. A lifelong forager of both liberal and metaphorical nourishment, Michelle teaches and writes at the crossroads of ecology, mythology, and personal liberation. Through land connection, story, and ritual, she helps others remember who they are and why they're here. She believes beauty is a survival skill and pleasure is wisdom and the body is an oracle. She is the founder of Forager Wildlife, a community for creative rebels, for rewilders and lovers of the untamed path. Here's Michelle now. It is so nice to have Michelle Dowd with me today and with all of us today. This is a story that is so resonant for so many people who have been raised in a different way and are trying to make their way in the world outside of it and adjusting. People actually don't know to the level of detail that you need to adjust, that you need to learn. When I work with people who were raised on compounds, when they were raised somewhere very remote or even within a family system that had its homeschooling, that did everything in-house, they don't know what to do if they go in a store, or they don't know how to decide what they want or what they like, how to feel about anything, or how to use a vending machine, or whatever it is. And it's hard when you come out as an adult to ask people those questions because they look at you like, I'm sorry, why do you? And so I would love to be able to talk all about that. But before we get into your story, I'd love you to take a moment to introduce yourself. Go for it.
Hi, Rachel. First of all, thank you so much for this conversation today. And already I am fully engaged because that has been my experience and it sometimes continues to be my experience. We will talk about that. My name is Michelle Dowd. I'm the author of Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult, which came out 2 years ago now, has changed my life because of the conversations that I am now having, like this one, but with so many men and women, more women, but a lot of men too, who come out of high control groups of different sorts, mostly religious, but many in different types of communes, and just how much less alone I feel because of these conversations. And how much I love showing up for people who also feel really alone and to say, look, there's a lot of us out here and we all have a long healing journey. And it seems like many people don't understand that that journey is really difficult and it doesn't end when you, quote, escape or get out or commit to yourself. It's just a long process. So thank you for understanding that, Rachel.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I want to be able to talk about that and how one adjusts and how you kind of make peace with a childhood that is potentially different than the one you might have wanted or chosen for yourself. And also to deal with something that comes up a lot in the work that I do is a feeling of isolation, and that you can feel isolated because of the decisions that were made by the people who brought you into this world and the life they chose for you that is different, or that's secluded, sequestered from the world. But I think also the isolation that sometimes continues, where you feel terminally unique, different. They have questions about things that you don't know if you're supposed to be questioning or other people question. And you can be in a room of 100 people and feel very much isolated and alone. And what to do with that. And sometimes I talk to clients about finding some points of connection. There has to be something that you have in common with that other person. I know before we got on, we were talking about music and instruments and, you know, the things that connect people. And so just trying to find that rather than sitting in the, I am very much different way of thinking, because that's very hard. So I would love for you to take us through, and I know we could talk for days about your story, about your childhood, about all of it, even just about your book. But if you can give us a chronology, how that life started even before you, and then when you were brought into the world, what a day in the life of Michelle was like.
I would love to just really briefly touch on the areas of connection, because this is something that I'm sure many listeners have had in one form or another. There are a lot of things I'm learning about popular culture from my various decades, but I still don't belong to the music of my generation or belong to understand cultural references that took place during my adolescence, but even during my 20s, because I had children young and I didn't ever really have those. I still have never been to a club. I never drank when I was young. I never had the experiences of free time or bonding, even after I left the cult. I never hung out. And one of the places I found connection that I think some people probably think is ironic is that the idea of church music, which I grew up playing and singing and felt like I've distanced myself from, I'm also incredibly comfortable in churches. So when I was traveling as a college student throughout Europe, I would go to churches and just sit in churches. And I met so many wonderful human beings who took me into their home and gave me a feeling of family centered around the music of churches. And that is something that I wouldn't have ever thought would have been meaningful to me, but was a lifesaver in multiple situations. So I don't feel like there is a day in the life of a cult member, at least the way I was raised. I think partly because the cult I was raised in was run by my grandfather, who was certainly mercurial, and he kicked people out all the time. He had really, really, really firm rules. And everyone in this cult came as a child. And this is something that has been just fascinating to me, is how many former cult members from where I come from who knew me when I was born, who knew my family before I was born. One gentleman's been talking to me a lot. He knew my father really well, both my parents, my grandpa, all that. He left before I was born, but he still feels this really deep family relationship with me because he was so raised by my grandfather. He has been writing letters. He and his wife have been just so generous with treating me like a family member. And there is something that happens inside a cult that is very bonding. Kind of, I think, the way that I hear people talk about military, like especially if you go into battle, your comrades in arms are people that are your family for life in intense ways that you can't really replicate just by marrying someone or giving birth to a child. And there are things about my experience in the cult that I feel that I have cult brothers and sisters who maybe we didn't keep in touch, but going back, even if they weren't in the same era as me, they really experienced a lot of the same isolation when they were leaving.
Right. Just to jump in there, but I'd love you just to build on that when we come back to you. I wanted to say that there are people who talk about it just like they felt like they were in the trenches together. They felt they had something in common in a way that unified them uniquely. Like the places, the people, the language, the beliefs, the experiences, and it does connect you. I think having something like that, even if it comes from a space that you don't want to be a part of anymore, it's still grounding. And you love being able to talk to people who will say, remember this, and I remember that tree over there, and this person, who then this happened, and the food. And that level of specificity is so unifying and so wonderful. And on top of it, having a situation where there was stress, having this grandfather who is mercurial, people being kicked out, there is something about connecting through stress that is also very bonding. I've talked to people who lived in New York during 9/11, and they were hiding under in a bus depot under a bench together as things are falling around them and collapsing, and they will be forever connected to the people they were hiding out with. So there is something about a shared experience that is intense. So on all those fronts, I could see why this would be very connecting.
Thank you for recognizing that. And yes, it is not uncommon, and there's so many different ways that we can have stressful experiences as bonding. I think that others might have had this experience too, is that when you get out, it's really hard to bond. I didn't know how to make friends. So in my particular case, being born there, and the fact that my mother was born there, and I think this is not everyone's experience in a cult. A lot of people have a before, during, and after. But there was a before for me. My mother was raised in this cult that started before she was born. My grandfather started it, like you can find records of it in 1931. I don't know, maybe it started in the late 1920s, but by 1931, it was in newspapers. And my grandmother married him in 36, I think. But like he started before he even married my grandmother. And then my mom was the fourth child. She's born in the 1940s. And I say this just to say, this is a long history in our family. And my mom didn't know anything else. And every single one of her siblings was still in the cult and taking care. I mean, every relative I had. So my dad is an only child. His dad died when my dad was a teenager, but they were separated before that. So my dad never saw his dad after he was 12. And his mom came to California to escape her abusive husband. And this is relevant because the moment they get here, she's trying to support a son while she's still legally married. She didn't get divorced. She was running away from him, hiding, trying not to have let anyone know where she was. And she got a job at a factory, the first woman in the factory post-World War II. And my father meets what will later become his father-in-law, but my grandfather meets him right away within maybe 2 weeks of getting to California. And so this man takes him under his wing, which, to be fair, I think my grandfather was looking for traumatized boys. I think he believed that he was giving them a father figure and giving them access to God, etc. So my father was ostensibly raised by the same man as my mom was raised by. My grandfather was far more of a father figure for him. So my parents grew up as siblings, basically. And then they married. And so what they gave me was the only experience that they had any familiarity with. And my father was very scared of the outside world. His mother moved back to the East Coast and she wasn't part of my upbringing. So I was only raised by biological relatives and other cult members. I never made a friend. I was born with my friends. I was born in the middle of two sisters, but I was also born just a month younger than two other girls who were born at the cult. And so all of us were just raised collectively. And I never had the experience of walking up and saying to someone, hi, I'm Michelle. Not what I did. And then there were times that I was a performer all over the United States and in Canada and Mexico, but the audience was always separate and we were earning money. And so we would separate our true selves from our performance selves. And I think it took me many years after leaving to realize that there was another self besides the performing self who could relate to other people. Sometimes I still go back into that space because it's like the safest way to not get hurt. You're not vulnerable if you're performing.
Yeah, you have a role. That is lovely. And I think that people like that. It's interesting. People have said to me that they would get involved in things like learning how to do catering, to be able to go to a party and know that you had a task. And then you didn't have to really think about who's going to approach me or who do I need to approach. You're supposed to approach everyone because you're giving them whatever, a drink or hot dogs or whatever. And so I think knowing that you're going to be doing something does help you with all of the unknowns, because then you have a known and you have a role, which I think can feel really calming. It's very interesting. I'm thinking now about the former cult member support group that I run now online, and that there are times that people will share something that's been difficult for them. And this is not always the case. And so if people are listening from the support group, I'm not talking about you necessarily, but there's just sometimes this silence that comes over because there is a lack of awareness that in that moment, you say something instead of thinking, well, that was part of God's plan for you, so we don't really have to feel bad. Or the person is discussing emotion and emotion is weakness. They have a lot of these thought-stopping things and behavior-stopping things that could really help people make a friend. So sometimes I'll model saying, that must be really hard. Does anyone else want to share their thoughts or their feelings or their hopes for the person who just shared this, to sort of teach people how to connect in that way? Because no, it's not taught. It's not natural. And you have Insta family and Insta community. And so you don't have to do any of the work. That is such an interesting point, the way you were raised, in that it really does fortifies you in some ways because it's lovely. But then how do you learn how to actually do it from scratch outside?
Yeah. And what you just said about emotion being weakness, I did not know that that was a typical cult experience, but of course it would be. And also I worked as a caterer, so that made me laugh. I still do this to this day. I'll just be like, who wants a drink? And I like go around all the time. Yeah, like I was 100% raised that emotion is a weakness. And we were taught to only have collective emotions. And so like there's appropriate time for emotions and they all need to be unified. And I imagine that is a very common experience of cult members.
Yeah, it really is. Collective emotion. I'm going to write that down because I want to make sure to come back to that. That is fascinating. It's reminding me of sometimes in other cultures where you have people who are professional criers. They come to things and they cry so everyone can cry. Wow, that is really very fascinating. Yes, emotions are often seen as a weakness. Although you can have love and adoration, you can also have fear. You can have emotions that are comfortable for the leader. The leader being someone who usually doesn't want to have to tolerate you being upset or you being upset with them, you being in pain, because they want you to just continue working and doing what you're supposed to be doing, even if you're in pain or if you're sick.
Yes, this isn't tolerated. You cannot admit to a physical weakness, or I love what you said about you can't be upset. You cannot express any feelings of, I don't like that. I don't want that. Yeah.
Right. And so we wonder why that is. And sometimes within certain fundamentalist groups, it'll be that somehow God isn't shining through you and you're not enlightened enough to feel positive all the time. But sometimes these groups are really run by these narcissistic personalities who in life outside of a cult also can't tolerate that. And they don't want someone to ever be upset with them. They don't want someone to not be in a position to be able to do whatever they're asked to do at any moment. They don't want to hear any quote unquote whining. Even if someone has broken something, it still might be whining. So I'm wondering how that was for you just growing up, if you were feeling sad or if you were in pain, what would happen? What did you do about that?
I honestly think most of that was beat out of me by the time I was 4 or 5. There was zero tolerance. My father absolutely wouldn't tolerate crying, for example. He would physically hit us if we cried until we stopped. And I'm guessing by 4, I didn't cry again until probably I was in my 20s. And even then, not much until I was in my 30s. My mom would say that you can't cry even in childbirth. She had these phrases about this, but you can never cry for yourself, no matter how much pain you're in. And I think sadness was just something, it was so not tolerated. I didn't have the verbal language around it. And when I think about how much was pre-verbal in my own experience, it's probably true that a lot of this was not tolerated long before I could have articulated any of these experiences. So a lot of my emotions, I think, surrounding family and intimacy are so scary, I think, because I wasn't given language when I most needed it. And now I'm searching for the language, but even then I'm really uncomfortable with emotions. Like, it's hard to be upset with somebody. It's hard to feel that they could tolerate that. It's hard to be in relationship with someone. If I'm upset, I feel like I cannot express it. I mean, I'm working on that. I think a lot of women struggle with this, quite honestly. I think in a different way. I won't speak to that at the moment. But for me, it has taken a lot for me to stand and take a moment. I don't generally yell or any of those kinds of things, but I can now say, hey, I'm not okay with that. I'm going to need a little bit of space to process. I'll say I need to process that. That was not okay with me. And it's taken a long time to get there. Again, I think this is common. I love the idea of other people coming together and learning to express emotion that is different from each other. So I teach, among other things, I teach yoga, and I've been running this self-care support group, basically. And I started doing this activity where people would create their own toolkit. And it was very important to me that no tool that I offered them did they put into their toolkit until A, they had tried it, until B, that it was working for them. And like, it doesn't belong in your toolkit if it's not working for you. Like, you don't have to meditate. You don't have to take a walk. You don't have to hug a tree. You know, there's nothing you need to do. But let's try some of these and see what works for you. One of the big things that kept coming up is for people to be able to articulate an emotion and sit with somebody else's emotion. But one thing we did with partnering off is we said, if I trust you, could I give you permission if you see me or hear me flailing at all? Let me give you permission ahead of time. We practice this with each other to remind me of something that you know works for me because I've told you that. So I had a friend she was in this group and she just wrote me yesterday and she said, have you put your feet in the dirt today, Michelle? And I said, hey, have you done your own, you know, whatever. So I shouldn't tell her story, but it's the idea of someone remembering that there are things that work for you and they're reminding you who you are. That has been such a powerful tool for so many. And this is just something I've been working with this group in this last year. And I thought, what a beautiful thing to identify for yourself what works for you and then give that to another person and say, please hold me accountable to this and remind me what I need. I won't always do what I need. And then doing that for another person as well, when they don't ask in the moment, but just checking in on them and like offering.
That's so beautiful. It's so beautiful that you've created that space and those opportunities and that guidance in that very respectful way, which I'm sure you've learned from your experience and you've refashioned it in terms of it being something that they have input on.
Yes, that's very important to me. Yeah.
That is really a beautiful, beautiful thing. And yeah, you also then get to find out who these people are and what would work for them. And it's not like I talk about on the podcast a lot that within cults, usually if all you have is a hammer, everyone has to be a nail. Like it's one for all, one-stop shopping, here's the answer. And that's not how people operate. It's not what's good for them. I think about one of my kids who gets actually very agitated when he's tried to meditate. It doesn't work for his system. When he's gone to places, they said, well, just try it more. And then he gets more wound up and he actually feels like aggressive and angry in a way that he doesn't. It's like one of those toy cars that gets spring loaded. So he said to me, what's wrong with me that I can't meditate? And I said, I think no one asked you. Like, is this what would help relax you? They could have asked me. And they said, what do you mean? I said, remember the times when you were growing up? And I said, let's go for a walk. And you thought that was a dependent clause. You thought that was, let's go for a walk to the store to get the thing. You don't just go for a walk. You go to go somewhere to take care of something, to get the thing that you need to fix it. It has to be, that has to matter. It has to mean something. It has to be for a purpose. So just having moments of reflection, what's important. But that's lovely that you've created this for so many people.
Thank you.
I really like that. I really like that a lot. And I would love to go back to this idea of collective emotion. That's fascinating to me. So tell me about that.
So this is not something that was named in our particular cult, but what I do know is we did play sports and it was very, very important. A word that they used all the time was unification, unity, unification, all that. And we would have these huddles even when we weren't actually playing a game and we would decide on what the word was. I shouldn't say we decided. The word was decided for us, and then we would give that word. And so part of what that was all of us had to experience the same thing at the same time. And I'll give you some examples. I will also say this is in context of also being hymn singers, where you go and you're all singing the same hymns at the same time, but you're also walking to chapel and you're singing Onward Christian Soldiers on the way up to chapel. And then you get there and then you sing this other song that's, I come to the garden alone while, you know, I'm speaking to God here on this mountain. And I think that a lot of it was very well orchestrated to be on the same beat. I think now that we understand what dance does for people or what choreography does, synchronization, that we were doing the motions together and then we were doing the vocalizations together and we're sitting together. We ate together. We slept in the same tents together. that all of it was about unifying. As a girl, our cycles were very unified, though mine mostly stopped as a teenager. I mean, I think I went like 4 years without a period, but I feel like there was a lot of the emphasis is that we are in the same, we are the same. We are one heartbeat. They would talk about this too, like we're all part of the army of God. So like there's all this part of the armor on the army of God, but we all play a role, kind of like an anthill. They used to talk about that, or like the queen bee and the cult leaders, like the king, of, even though they're queens, who's a woman in our situation. But I think that the idea that we are all serving a role, but we are part of the same body of Christ. So you weren't a separate person. I didn't know I could have emotions that were separate. I really didn't know that. I wouldn't have been able to say to myself, I feel sad, don't show that. I didn't experience the feeling of sadness unless we were having collective grief over the death of my grandpa, or like if we had a service together and we experienced it, then you could experience that emotion, but only if the container was holding it.
Oh, that's very interesting. Oh my goodness. So just you learning your emotions, it needed to almost be prefaced by you needing to validate that you could have your own and give yourself permission for that. I think when people have this idea of collectivism, then they judge something that comes up for them thinking it's wrong or it's misplaced. Yeah, I'm so curious about that. I'm so curious to get to that. Oh, and I want to just hear a little more about growing up. And then I want to come back to this point about being in the world, but also just learning how to feel in the world. My goodness. Wow. So much that you've been busy doing that you've had to do. So tell me about your time in the group and how long you were there and when you left.
So as I mentioned, I was born there. I was not born on the mountain. I was born down in the suburbs on the border of El Monte. My mom was born in Pasadena. So it was San Gabriel Valley. Until I was seven, we lived mostly with my nuclear family. We were surrounded by other cult members. I was raised collectively. My mom handed us over at 2 days old to a group. I've been met a lot of my earlier caregivers who I didn't know who took care of me as a baby. But I would say I probably had, 15 different caregivers a week. People would come in for an hour or 2 hours, but it wasn't only me. It was like a whole group of us. And mostly they were 12 and 13-year-old girls who took care of lots of infants. And one of them I've been meeting with quite a bit, and she has all these old pictures and just things I'd never seen, because her brother, he unfortunately passed of COVID during COVID, but he was a photographer, or I mean, it was something he sort of did on his own, but he snapped pictures as a teenager there. And so she has all of these, she inherited them from her brother. And so she's been bringing them to me. We'll meet for lunch and she brings them. I have these boxes, and it's been so powerful for me just to like sit with this. I mean, there's not pictures of me as a baby, but I didn't grow up with pictures. So I didn't know who I was. I've learned so much from these various caregivers, like the way we were kind of hosed down instead of given a bath by the time we were two or three. Like they would just hose off, they take off your diaper and just hose you, and it was cold, or just things like that. One caregiver told me how it bothered her so much, and she would try to make sure we got warm afterwards, or like just things that she remembered that I never would have remembered because I was so young. So I was raised like that. And then my grandfather was, I think, getting, I don't love this word, crazy. He was getting more eccentric and more extreme by the time I was probably five or six. Like, I think he went into the last decade of his life, stuff he never used to do. Like, he would hoard money. He was just doing all sorts of unpredictable behaviors. And so the way I particularly was raised was very chaotic. There was a fire. Everything we had burned up. And when I was seven, we ended up moving up to this mountain that my grandfather had leased from the government back in the 1940s, but was only using as a kind of a spiritual retreat. And so his daughter, my mother, took her children and moved. We were alone on the mountain, and we had one guy who was living with us, and then other men started living with us, usually two at a time. So it wasn't a lot who would rotate in and out of our home. And when I say men, they were probably men between the ages of 22 and 30. And they would help with the physical labor of being on a mountain. My biological family lived there until I left for college when I was 17. So that's where I was raised. Now, because we were an itinerant group, I would often be on the road staying in tents and doing other activities, but that's the only home I ever had again. And we moved into a mess hall, which was an old kind of like army, that was full of army bunks. We had an outhouse. Like it was a one room. It was a one room space, and we slept in army bunks, and then we would walk down to the outhouse, and we didn't have showers and just that kind of stuff. So I was raised we kind of thought it was old fashioned, maybe. There was a party line. There was a phone that we weren't allowed to use, but I guess it would have been used in emergencies or if my mom probably had to contact her father to see what we should do. And it would snow and do different things. So we'd get snowed in and we did a lot of foraging. But because I got ill, which is in the book, I think I had a really different experience. So when I was 10, they found out that I had an autoimmune disease, which may have been in response to various forms of abuses, I think. But in any case, I ended up in the hospital in Los Angeles on and off for the majority of 3.5 years. Because I was separated during that time, again, the only home I had was the mountain, but I was in the hospital a lot. And so I was separated from the group enough to see that there was another way of living. Now, that being said, a children's hospital is a very isolated experience. Siblings don't come in. My siblings never came. That wasn't uncommon. I was in the cancer ward. I was in hematology oncology. So you have cancer roommates. Everybody needed to be careful about germs. And so we wouldn't have been exposed. My dad never visited once. Neither did my grandparents. Only my mom was the only one who ever came in and out. She often didn't come because she was really busy. She had other children. She was running organizations. She was a cult member. And all of that was very hidden. And we got money from Ronald McDonald House. Things were paid for. But I think in those days, I mean, I went into the hospital at the end of the 70s and stayed through the early 80s. I think in that time, there weren't a lot of questions asked about psychological health and the abuses I was experiencing physically. The bruises went away after a couple of weeks. And then my dad wasn't hitting me because I was in the hospital. And so I wasn't really necessarily experiencing those same abuses. Now, that being said, I had learned to hide the truth of where we came from, because that when we were doing what I call panhandling, but when I was asking for money on street corners and doing that stuff and selling things, I'd been trained since I was a very, very little girl to lie to authorities, never give my real name, all of those kinds of things so they wouldn't be implicated. I think I just used those skills when I was in the hospital. So where a lot of people would say to me now, like, oh, you were so fortunate because you had somebody who could take care of you. I would say there's wonderful things about being cared for by a nurse, but the nurses also have a really big job to do. They have a lot of people to take care of. They're not sitting at your bedside reading to you. They're taking your blood 3 or 6 or 10 times a day. They're making sure that they're measuring your urine. And so it is, yes, you're cared for, but you're also being poked and prodded. And so it doesn't always feel like care. It feels like invasion.
Right. And how was it talked about too? Yeah, I'm sure it feels like invasion. My goodness, right. Especially when you're young. And you don't have someone there in your room with you all the time to compensate.
I mean, I was having bone marrow tests and bone marrow transplants and things that are very painful. The invasion was real. And then I had surgery, of course.
Okay, so to stay with that for a moment, you're having bone marrow transplants. Oh my goodness. And you were not supposed to complain or cry or express that you were in pain. So how did you handle all of that? And was there any wondering about why you might not have been responding? I'm just wondering what they thought and how you handled it, because that's all scary and painful.
Thank you for acknowledging that. I feel like I couldn't even acknowledge that to myself at the time. I was very fortunate that I had my main doctor. His name was Dr. Shore. That's his real name. He was an oncologist, and he was accustomed, I think, to talking to children and asking, are you okay with me doing this? I don't remember asking how I felt emotionally, but it was like, here's what I'm going to do. It's going to hurt. He would tell me that. He was an older gentleman, just had a really good bedside manner, I would say. He was able to explain the procedures and he would clear all my procedures. A lot of times nurses would do the procedures, but he was the one who would decide. And he would sometimes say, I'm going to need you to be very brave. Can you do that today? That kind of thing. If today's not a good day for you, we could wait till tomorrow. I felt I had some choice, but I remember being in a great deal of pain and not being able to talk about that. And I also remember my siblings later said to me too, like they didn't even know what I was in the hospital for. They didn't know where I went for a couple years. There was just this silencing. And so there was a lot of shame inside of me for being weak for having emotions, but also being weak for getting sick. And my grandfather really put me out there as being the scapegoat, or like basically the way that God was punishing me for not being compliant. Maybe punishing my mom. I mean, there was just a lot. My mom had so much shame about having a daughter in the hospital. She felt that I was doing it to her. She thought I was fabricating. She used that word a lot, which is an interesting word. Fabricating emotion. Like if I said it was her, she's like, no, it doesn't. Like she would do that thing. She's like, no, it doesn't. They're doing what's best for you. You should be grateful. They're taking care of you. You would be dead if they weren't taking care of you. that kind of thing. You're not allowed to complain. And she was just very big on that. But I believe that she really believed that. In her own way, my mother was there more than anybody else was there. Like, she was showing up and making sure. And she would talk to Dr. Shore. And my mom was very intelligent and very presentational. So she would say the right things, I think. She would say, Michelle's fine with that. She would just say she can handle it. She's very strong. And my mom would speak about me that way. And I think that it made me feel that I needed to continue to be that thing that she said that I was.
It's very interesting. I think about that in a smaller way for me growing up with siblings who often fought, and I came a ways after them. And I think it was important for my parents to know that they had a child who was going to be okay with whatever. And then I would hear a conversation in the other room. Well, what are we going to do? And where are we going to go? And well, should we ask Rachel? She'll be fine with anything. And I remember thinking, oh, that's me. That's who I need to be in this family. And it informed my decisions about some of the early relationships I got into with people who were very controlling, who loved to fill in that space and decide and tell me, like, what order for me at a restaurant? She wants this. I'll be like, okay, I guess I do. Takes a while.
What number child in your family?
Three. Well, 8 years after the one who was before me. It was like being an only child to a certain degree, but I think, yeah, my parents, we are so tired of the fighting and the back talking and the whatever. We need an easygoing person. And I still am an easygoing person, but I didn't know that I could also have an opinion, and I didn't get to practice disagreeing and what that might do, or that I assume that would be devastating. So it's an interesting thing that your perspective can be off, like hearing your mom say to the doctor, she'll be fine. Or she'll be okay with that, or she's okay with that. And I'm sure you weren't asked, but it was just stated, which is really interesting. And then you feel you have to rise to that occasion, whatever that occasion is. How interesting. I was going to ask before how it was seen that you were sick. So you answered that it really was God. It was weakness. It brought shame, which is adding insult to injury, quite literally.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of it wasn't talked about at all. Spoken to my father, who's still alive since my mom passed, went through a period of time in his grief, I think, when he was a little bit more open to conversation. But he doesn't even remember me being sick. He knew I was. He said, well, it was very hard on your mother. You put your mother through a lot. That's the kind of way that he'll say it now. And I see that he really feels that. Like, you caused us all sorts of problems. And that's what he'll still say to this day. And his mind is fully functioning. Like, he has a memory. He knows exactly how to get everywhere. My dad won't use any sort of, I just think this is funny, but he won't use any sort of GPS device or like try to say, Dad, put it on your phone for you. Because he does have a phone, but he won't. He has to go places by memory, or you have to tell him. He won't even write it down. He just likes to use his brain, and it's very old school. So it's not that his brain is gone. He just literally does not think that what I did was fair to the family. Like, it was so awful for them that they had to go through that.
Incredible.
I think that's how I felt growing up. And I think I love, Rachel, that you shared about this, like getting in relationships, because it is really true, especially if you're getting in a romantic / intimate / possibly even domestic relationship with people who you don't think you're choosing that. But the truth is, it's easier to be around somebody who's controlling because they don't ask you what you feel. That's the part that I had to come to as my role in it. Not that I did it on purpose. I was choosing to be with people who didn't care how I felt, because somebody caring how I felt was honestly paralyzing to me.
Oh my goodness.
I'm sure other people have had this experience. It's just, it took me a long time to get to the point. It's like, oh, this is comfortable for me. I can disappear in this relationship and they won't notice. I don't matter. And I didn't know that at the beginning, but like looking back, I'm like, oh yes, that's why. I didn't want to abuse, I didn't want to be controlled. But on the other hand, what if I was with somebody who loved me and said, what do you want all the time? That would have been horrifying at 19. I was like, nothing. I don't want anything. That's just too much for me.
And also, it can feel like it's a potential trap, because you don't know that it's not yet. You don't know that if someone says, well, what movie do you want to see? That if you pick it and they don't like it, you're never going to hear the end of it. Like, oh, is this safe? Do I get to say? Do I actually get to choose? And then, yeah, it becomes easier not to. That's really interesting.
I didn't even know movies. I didn't know, so if someone said, this is what we're going to do, I'm like, okay, how would I ever know what I want? I feel like I honestly still to this day, Rachel, still have to remind myself, and I have to take a moment and say, all right, like even on the littlest choices, like a restaurant menu, how do you even choose? Like sometimes that's still hard. Yeah.
Yes, it's very hard. Sometimes also having choices is hard. You still want this structure of just tell me where to go, what to do, and everyone will be happy. Everyone around me will be happy and I get to stay calm. I might not still have any connection to myself, but I'll be able to be calm and feel safe in that. So here you had exposure to the outside world, even though it was inside a hospital, but still. And I'm sure just hearing conversations and what people talked about a little bit, and it's different. And then you were able to go off to college. I'm sure that was a huge change for you. So during this time of you being able to gain more independence in your life, I'd love to know just what it was like for you to leave to go to college. Was that typical too, that people in the group?
No, I was very excommunicated for making that what didn't feel like a choice to me. I was already getting shunned. Shunned and excommunicated are two different things in the cult that I was in. To be shunned meant no one's allowed to speak to you. And so I went through that as a teenager for a couple of reasons, mainly because I had a dalliance kind of thing with a boy and who a couple years older than me. So people were not allowed to speak to me. So I wasn't allowed to play on this team. You get together, you'd be like, fight, or whatever the word is. But like, you then are part of that group. So I was shunned from the group. I still had to go to those things, but was not allowed to participate. People would actively not speak to me. So like, if I spoke, they would not speak back. And so I was already very, very isolated at that point. And my family stopped speaking to me. They thought that I'd shamed them for talking to this boy. So by the time I was 17, I was already so alienated, kind of sneaking off to do house cleaning so I could get some money for food. And then I would save that money in this little cup. And my dad, if he found it, would take it, but he wouldn't report it because he needed the money. So he didn't really necessarily want to know where I was getting it. I wasn't selling drugs, but I could have been. And I don't think he would have known. I could be selling my body and he wouldn't have contested that. I think he would have cared at that point. But when I went to college, it was because I was house cleaning for a woman who gave me an application. I went to a college that is one of the Claremont colleges, and it started in the 60s and they were experimental and didn't have, for example, general ed and things like that. When I got there, they tested. But anyway, they accepted me without me really applying. It was kind of a long story. But I tested out of things like writing classes. And I mean, I had just been very self-taught and very independent. And I think they really liked my unusual background. So I got a full ride to college. And I had dorms at 17. And that completely freaked me out. So the book I wrote, Forager, stops there. And a lot of people have asked what happened since. And so I'm writing a book right now called Ballad of a Prodigal Daughter. In this story, which is not linear, it goes back in time to take you back to that time. But it's helped me re-explore. And I just taught meditation and a bunch of other eating disorder stuff at my college, my alumni, although they pay me to come and do that, I'm able to connect with young people who also have really unconventional backgrounds, who are often still accepted to this school. It's a very social justice oriented place, and they people from different backgrounds so that everybody gets the experience of working with people who didn't come from backgrounds like they did. And so that was a huge part of, I think, the healing process for me, is just to move into a place where I felt like I was crazy because I hadn't had these experiences and nobody else that I know of came from a cult. But I think there was a lot of tolerance for outsider behaviors. And so I did that at 17. Now, that being said, I couldn't date. I moved into a co-ed dorm. It was really terrifying for me. I felt scared of men. I felt scared of outside world. So I ended up getting married to one of the guys from the cult while I was in college, had children young. I had four children really quickly, went to grad school with babies, did all of that. I mean, I'm just really grateful that I managed to stay in school. School was safe space for me. I went to Boulder, Colorado as a writer in residence, and they paid for grad school for me. And I was in a PhD program. And so I ended up sort of finding academia as a place where I could thrive and where I could eventually get paid and have healthcare for my children. And I didn't do what I see a lot of people doing, which is so beautiful, is taking the time in their 20s to figure out who they are. I already had all those kids. And so I just learned to raise them and in the process remothered myself a little bit. But I don't think it was until my 30s when my older girls, I had twins to start with, they graduated from high school while I was still in my 30s. I don't think it really hit me that I needed to figure my life out because I was working and that seemed responsible and I, you know, whatever. it hit me a little bit later. And I think it does hit a lot of women, depending on when they become other things. I had to sort of deal with pain that I had been repressing for decades, you know, back around age 40, where all of a sudden there was just so much that I had never cried about, never grieved, never experienced. Yeah. And it was sort of took my daughters getting older and going off to college themselves for me to go through what I probably should have done at 19 or 20. I didn't really fully do.
Wow. My goodness. Having children, a lot of people will talk about either having their own or being exposed to a sibling who's raising their children or whatever else. And they see how they are feeling attuned to children and their emotions and that they care and they want to know how they can help and they want to understand what happened and that that's just this sort of natural proclivity. And you start to see the comparison, like side-by-side panels of your life and the life you're giving to your kids that feels way more, I think, natural or nurturing to you, which I'm assuming it was for you and for your children, but you had to learn it on the spot. I think it wasn't modeled for you at all. So how did you learn how to do that, to do that role?
Well, I was a research freak. College was the place that I was learning. So I went to, when I lived in Boulder, I went to the library all the time and I made index cards. I researched early childhood development. I ran a newsletter actually called Smart Kids and had a huge mailing list. And I wrote articles. I wrote all the articles on how to raise, at the time I cared about my kids being intelligent. But I had adjectives like what I would say key concepts that were important to me. Like I wanted kids who were resilient. I wanted kids who were curious. I wanted kids who had access. I know I wrote the word emotion. I wanted them to know their emotions. So I would have these, I didn't use post-its, I used index cards, and I would write down the quality, like resilience. And then I did all the studies to find out what taught that. And so, for example, like I had all these little plastic blocks when they were just so little and would build the towers. And then when one would knock it over, I would say like, oh, yay, now we get to redo it. I would write down, be happy when something goes wrong because then they see it not as a failure, you know, and stuff like that. And I literally just wrote down all these qualities. And I cared about language. I wanted them to have access to language. So I wrote that down. Here's another funny one, but I didn't believe in barriers. So like I would have their mattress be on the floor, which I think is very Montessori, even though my kids didn't go to Montessori, but I didn't believe in play plans. And I said to myself, when I'm home and I work from home a lot, they will have access to me, but I will also say to them, and this was written down, but I'm in here working. And this is where like maybe a one-year-old. So come get me anytime you want. I'm right behind this wall right here. Here's how you get here, you know? And then I would try to have the whole house be safe so that I didn't have to watch them, but they could find me. Now we lived in like a 700 square foot house. So it was like really small. So I didn't use monitors or anything. There was no doors really. But I think that this was really important to me that their curiosity was rewarded by them being able to have access to, like if they opened a drawer, they could decide what was in it. I don't know. I just didn't have boundaries around that kind of stuff. And I think because I remember there was a lot of Japanese culture I was very attracted to, like the not saying no till the child's five, some of that, saying there's going to be boundaries, but it's not going to come early on. And I think that I just felt really, really committed to intellectualizing it instead of trying to go from my gut, because I think I felt like I would just completely mess it up or that I'd pendulum and do the opposite. I was married to their father, and he also was raised in the cult, but he came from a quote, normal family before he joined the cult at age 7. So he had a little bit more outside structure, and he also became a teacher, but he was an elementary teacher. And so he also believed in a lot of these principles, or he would let me kind of lead it. But he also believed that it was really great to have structure, but that you wouldn't put any arbitrary rules out there. Like the only rules we would have, we understood what they were for. So like, you're not going to go on the street. And so we wouldn't use, for example, we didn't use the word no, unless we could explain to the kid why we didn't want them to get hit by a car or whatever. But we wouldn't say, no, you can't say that because that's arbitrary. Why is a cuss word bad versus another word? You know, that kind of stuff. So just really, really deliberate. Now, that being said, the kids all are doing really well. They're all partnered. And one of my twin daughters has twin daughters now, which is just kind of really interesting. Fraternal twin girls, just like she's a fraternal twin girl. And watching her and her sister with the babies is just such a, they're always together with, and they live in the same town. We which is the same city I live in. And they're both married to men who get along really well. So it's really fun to kind of watch them have more access to, I guess, community than I had.
That's really delightful. They're very sweet, though, to see the twins having twins. And oh, wow. Okay, so one of the things that you mentioned that I think is really, really important to highlight, because it's true for so many people raised in these kinds of environments, is that when you're raised, you have one source of information and you have one answer, and the person, your grandfather, who was it, and he probably could speak for God and whatever came through him, but he was it. Then you're suddenly in college with all these other sources of answers and information. And you need to probably learn how to ask, how to get the information that you have, and also experiment with maybe disagreeing with what you're being taught. And then this tradition continues when you're doing the index cards, going to the library, also resourcing other sources and seeing that the world is filled with sources, but you also sometimes have to discern which ones are okay and which ones are not, which is its own stress. They're like, how do you know? And let's read a study, but also let's see first who funded it. So like just knowing how to participate in deciphering what information you've accessed is right, is salient, is kosher, as they say in my family. But I'm wondering for you just what that was like to suddenly have this world open up to other people having the answers and you also being able to ask the questions.
I think because my grandfather was the one who spoke for God and I saw behind closed doors that he wasn't kind, I think I had so much aversion to anyone who thought they had the answers. So when I got into a college classroom, if a professor would say they knew, I would say, how do you know that? Because I think you're allowed to do that, first of all. But I feel like I asked so many questions and I was like, okay, but how do you know that? Where did you get that? How did you learn that? And to be fair, and I think this is a beautiful thing, I think most professors took very well to that. I had much better relationships with professors than I did with other students because other students didn't make sense to me. My peers were not somebody I could understand, but the professors I felt like had some knowledge I really wanted. So I'm still friends with some of the professors I had in college. I just had a memorial service for one of the women's husbands. And like, I really feel that they were so respectful of my curiosity. I mean, I think it was exciting for them to have somebody who really honestly was like, I don't understand. Where did you learn that? Like, where did that come from? That was rewarded at 17. And I think I came to it at just the right time in my life where I was being rewarded for asking questions. And so I honestly just continued to do that as a teacher. And I always went by my first name. I tried to eliminate hierarchies with my college students. I was very young when I started teaching college. I was 21. And so I think at the beginning, it was just legitimately like, well, we are all peers here. But as I continued up to the age that I am now, I always went by my first name. I was always like, if I don't know something, I will tell you and we will find it out together. I'm not the harbor of knowledge. I have more probably than you do because I have a lot of experience, but you know things that I don't know and that's beautiful. So let's see what we can put together and let's see if we can find a solution. And I think I learned that early in college and I'm so grateful that I got the opportunity to keep practicing because the truth is, I think the more we know, the more we don't know. So of course, there's a lot I don't know even now. And I just love that the questions, I think, at the end of the day are more important than the answers. That's always the part of it. And that's how we keep learning is just always realizing that asking better questions is how we get to wherever the information that we need.
Very true. I remember going to an exhibit at the Skirball Center. My mom, for a time, had been in charge of the special events and the different exhibits that they had there. One of the exhibits was about Einstein. And something that was a takeaway, because I might not really understand all about relativity still. That's okay. I say to myself, that's okay. But one of the things that I will never forget is that when his mom would greet him after a school day, instead of asking him, what did you learn? She would ask him, what did you ask? And it was all about the questions, how you find out. And what did you find out from the questions that you asked, which was so fascinating that it's about inquiry.
I've never heard that story, Rachel. Thank you for sharing that. That's beautiful.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I love that. I want to go back and parent now and ask that question.
Like, damn, I missed my E.
I'm fine.
I'll do it maybe when I have grandkids. Fine. Okay. I'll save it. But I did want to ask about the finding connection, the points of connection, and how you did that even early on, because that's not easy when your life has felt so different.
I think I'm obsessed with connection, to be honest. I'll say right now, one of the beautiful ways I'm making connections is I run a weekly newsletter, which is housed on Substack, but you don't have to be on Substack. I just send it out in via email. And I have made so many wonderful connections with other humans who are readers. And I do respond. Like if students, or not students, I shouldn't call them readers, some of them are students. But if people are reading this and I'm asking questions, always ask questions in the newsletter. I ask people to ask these questions of themselves. They certainly aren't expected to answer them, but I give opportunities if they want to. And sometimes people will come and respond to my newsletter because they can just respond and it'll come back to me with a question. And I love that so much. So that is a form of weekly connection that I am perpetually in communication with people I've never spoken to before who have questions about all sorts of things in life, including foraging. I mean, I do focus a little bit on how to learn to forage in your community, literally with plants. So I'd say with connection that for me, connecting to the earth has been a huge part of how I have rewilded myself, who I've healed in learning wherever I am, that there's always something around you. And this is something that I think a lot of us don't know. Even if you're living in a city, within a mile of you, there's all sorts of edible food growing in your own community, in the weeds. There's a lot of options. And when you learn what you can connect to and like the idea of putting it into your body, and we don't have time to get into the safety right now. So if you are listening, there are safe ways to do this and just Google safety on the internet under foraging and you can at least find the resources of how to do this safely. But we can connect and put into our own bodies that which is growing naturally from the earth that wasn't even necessarily planted. Maybe a bird planted it or whatever. That has been a huge source of connection because I feel like it's really grounding to me to be connected to the land I'm walking on and feel like I am part of the cycle of life. And then the other thing about connection with other humans that I started doing really early on, even though I didn't know how to make friends, I really don't think, I was just thinking about this morning, I think I made my first real friend at probably 25. I didn't think how to do that in college and grad school. I did some, and I started making friends with people who like had kids when my kids would play together. But the first time I made a friend for myself, a woman named Brooke, she was a fellow mom, but she gave me a book called The Horse Whisperer. And we started riding together. And I had been raised, among other things, so I did many things as a child, working at a stable where I was taking care of horses. And so I had ridden really early in life. And we bonded over that. And we talked about the difficulties that we found feeling isolated as moms. And we started meeting every single week in the park and bringing our kids. And then like one of us would play with the kids while the other one could use the bathroom or doing things like that. But we talked about ourselves. And I'd never really been around another mom who would talk to me about her. That connection meant so much to me that I said to myself, I'm never going to be without that again. And so I would, in any group, and I still do this to this day, if I'm going to be part of something, I always look for the person who looks like the outsider. But just a question I ask really frequently in maybe different forms, but I'll say, hey, you know, I'm Michelle, whatever. Why are you here? What brought you here today? What are you doing? Like, what are you doing here? Because sometimes you're just like, this person doesn't look like they, quote, belong, but I'm not going to say that. And they'll say, I don't, you know, and they'll tell a story. And almost invariably, it's that vulnerability of being awkward about it that I can say, oh, wow, I feel like that too. Or I used to feel like that. Do you want my number? And like being the person who makes the gesture instead of waiting for someone to come to me. And I think that that's just something I learned since I didn't know how to do things that I was like, oh, I have to be the one to initiate because I almost feel like attacked almost if someone initiates or at least younger. So now I just feel like that's maybe one of my life goals is to recognize that we're always connected and then to celebrate the connections that already exist, but to realize that there's never too much connection, that you and I, Rachel, there's always something that we have in common, always. And when we touch base on that, nobody from any culture who doesn't even speak a language that I do, we still have so much more in common than we have that's different. Yes. Part of the wonderful thing about having a newsletter is I have a lot of readers in different countries and something like a little kind of game I play with myself. But whenever I travel, unless I'm in a huge hurry, nearly 100% of times I travel, I connect with somebody that I know that I've never met before, but I know through our shared readership or something. And I just know people all over the world because of that. And it just helps you recognize that we're not isolated. And it's fun just to meet. I mean, obviously I do it when it's convenient for them where they live. But I mean, like, if you want to get a cup of coffee, often they invite me into their homes because they're just happy about that. But even in a coffee shop, you have this moment, you're like, oh my goodness, it's so beautiful to see you in person. Thank you for taking this 15 minutes. Appreciate you.
Oh, that's so beautiful. In light of all of that, tying things together here, one last question for you, and then I want to ask you about where people can find you and all your work. When you were talking about meeting up with this woman, making your first friend at 25 and getting together weekly, and that she would talk about how she was feeling, what about you? Did you talk about you or did you listen? And at what point did you maybe realize it's okay for you to talk about you? And also, if you talk about you, you're not, and this is, I'm pooling from people, I guess from my own life too, but mostly from people who have been in these situations where they couldn't have a self and they couldn't talk. When did you feel like you weren't taking up time and her time by talking about you, and that you weren't going on too long and you weren't revealing things you shouldn't? All the things that come with this, where you might make it look effortless, but people don't know all that's happening inside while you're doing this. When did you start to feel like you could share too?
Okay. You just said that so perfectly because you just got me to remember. No, of course I didn't tell her anything about me. But she still felt like a friend because I could listen and she was personable. She also moved away. So I think the friendship, she moved away. We probably only had a year and a half before she moved. She and her family moved far away. But she just wrote me the other day. So, I mean, it's nice. It was nice to hear from her. But I would say, I think it was when I was 31 and I met a man online, not dating, but like met him in a quilting sort of chat room, long story. But he asked me questions. And every time I didn't ask the question, he asked it again in a different way. And we were pen pals for probably 3 years before we met in person. So I probably have a history of this. But he is the first one, and he has passed away during COVID. But he did not let me change the subject. He kept bringing it around. I don't know if he wasn't so insistent. His father was a minister, and his father had left the ministry and lost his faith and then became a music professor. And we came from so much hymn culture, H-Y-M-N. And also, there was just things that we had in common that he just knew that I was pretending all the time. And I think he was the person who could truly see how unparented I was, how much I needed. He had so much care for me. He shared so much of that. But I never told anybody I was in a cult, ever. I didn't use the word until I wrote the book. And in fact, my publishers put it on the cover when I did not want it on the cover, because as you might know, you don't get the right to name your own book after you sell it. I'm good that they did now, because I understand that I did come from a cult. I just was taught never to call it a cult, literally taught that. So I think that it's still difficult for me. I would much rather, and I got into journalism, so asking questions then became my profession. And it's a beautiful thing to be able to ask other people questions and not have to answer them yourself, because it's not your profession to answer questions. So like coming on interviews like this is probably in the last 2 years when I learned to talk about myself, because when you agree to do an interview and you're on this side of it, you have to answer questions. That's part of it. But I would love for listeners to actually read Forager if they're open to that. It's on Spotify if you happen to have a Spotify premium account or Audible. I narrated it, but you can also buy it anywhere books are sold. It's still on shelves in bookstores, and in the airport, people are still sending me pictures. And when I go into a bookstore, sometimes I look and I'm like, oh, there it is. But if you need to buy it online, that's fine too. But yeah, so there's hardback, paperback version that has some questions at the end and has a little bit of a new intro. And then there's also Kindle, and you can do that. But the audio version, I consider that reading. I think a lot of people are like, is that okay? And I'm like, well, it's always okay. So that's where you can find it. But also, if you are interested in my newsletter, if you go to my website, it's probably the easiest way to do it, at michelledowd.org. And there's a pop-up and it says, if you'd like to share your email, then become part of my subscriber list. And then you just, if you don't want to subscribe, you just unsubscribe. It's one click at the top of the email. So it's really easy to get out of, and there's no charge. But that is the way that I'm communicating with people these days. Instead of just giving everyone my email, I'm doing a weekly newsletter, but I'm also will answer people individually if they're on my email list, because then at least I know that what kind of conversations we're able to have. And if then they're willing, I'll ask them too, hey, can I quote you? I would love to tell a bit about your story. I have guest posts from people, stuff like that. So I'd love for people to join me there if you're willing to share your email.
Yeah. And so all of this will be also included in the show notes for the episode. So people will have the links. It was such a total treat to talk to you today. Really, really beautiful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel. Your questions are just so warm and powerful.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Michelle for what she shared with us today. It is very powerful to hear about her life experiences, about being sequestered on a mountain, being in a family-run cult, having your exposure to the world be in a children's hospital room, and being able to, I think, for the first time, get some kind of compassion and care from people who are working at the hospital. And even though her mom was there still, that was fraught with conflict because Michelle was made to feel that she was sick through fault of her own, not no fault of her own, but through her own fault because of something that she did wrong, because of something she was that was wrong. And then afterwards to be told that she made things hard for her family and that she put her mom through a hard time. I mean, the blaming the victim part of these stories is so palpable so often, and it's so cruel, especially to do to children. Any kind of diagnosis is seen as a weakness, any kind of psychological diagnosis, physical diagnosis. So here you are, scared, not knowing what's going on, probably in pain, receiving treatments that are painful, and then being given emotional pain that you're the one causing problems for your family and causing your parents to suffer. And then also spiritual pain, like, why does God not love me? Why is God punishing me in this way? I just can't imagine coming out from under that. That would be extremely hard just to have any modicum of self-esteem, I think, and self-concept with any kind of confidence or self-acceptance or feeling like you're okay. And also without having this unyielding amount of guilt that you did something wrong, so you deserve to get sick, or you did something wrong by being sick. Ugh, just drives me crazy when I think about this. And it happens so often, almost all the time. One of the things also that she talked about was this idea of collective emotion. And it really does remind me of when nurses or doctors sometimes walk into a hospital room and they'll say, how are we feeling today? And I know that once happened when I had had surgery and the nurse walked in and said, how are we feeling today? And of course I said, I don't know how we're feeling. I feel terrible. I'm in a lot of pain. Hopefully you're feeling better because you're the one taking care of me. She unfortunately did not have a sense of humor, so she didn't know where I was going with that. But still, it is important to really understand that if you all need to experience the same emotion at the same time and for the same reason and for the same duration of time and to the same degree, then when do you get to start to have any kind of awareness of or relationship with your own emotions? So many people who I talk to will say, I think I'm feeling such and such, but I don't know. And sometimes they really don't know. And you stop really having feelings register. And sometimes you stop having pain register if there's no one there to tend to it. And there's no one there who cares, or you're going to be judged or blamed for it anyway. So what's the point of even being aware of it to that degree? But also, when you really don't know how you're feeling, you might say, I'm not sure if I'm sad. Other people are asking me if I'm sad about this. Am I supposed to be? Is that okay? Those kinds of emotions, sadness, anger, all of it are considered weaknesses, are considered sinful sometimes. And so part of the reason is, of course, because they threaten the leader. You're supposed to be happy, or for some groups where you're supposed to suffer, being happy is actually sinful. Whatever it is that the leader doesn't want you to feel and doesn't want to have to deal with and doesn't want to have to feel sorry for, doesn't want to have to feel responsible for, makes the leader feel like they don't have full control over you, well, that's the thing that you're not going to be able to feel. But really anything that shows you to be an individual is going to be threatening. So we've all had the experience, I'm sure, where we've noticed other people getting upset and we're not upset, or other people seem fine and we're the ones crying. It happens if I go to see a movie and something happens to the animal in the movie, I'm going to lose it. And I'm going to look around and I might be the only one reaching for a tissue or one of the very few. But I have a sense that even though I might be getting emotional, that it's not off that I'm feeling this way. This is part of the spectrum of normal human reaction to things. There's no such thing as a spectrum within cults. Cults usually have very backward and very rigid way of looking at things. It's very black and white. And so it can't be that some people are going to feel a little bit sad, more sad, tragically sad, despondent, depressed, and it's all okay. Some of it probably needs to be addressed and dealt with, but it's all within the normal range. There isn't that level of emotional sophistication within cult groups. And if they do notice you feeling something, right away they're going to go to, what did you do to bring it on? What did you do to bring it in? What did you do to call it in? What did you do to manifest that? What did you do to cause yourself to feel this way? Whatever the language is that I've heard a million times, it's on you. So when you have people who then have collective emotion, you also have a sense of community. Wow, these are all people who feel the same way I do about things, and I feel really then close to them. But they may or may not be having the same feelings as you. They just may have been told that they're supposed to. Or it could be social contagion. One person starts to cry, other people start to cry. One person seems to feel happy or elated, and the other ones don't want to seem like the only one who's not getting it and seeming happy with what's going on. So they might then put a smile on their face and try to talk themselves into being happy or faking it till they make it. It's very hard to get a genuine sense of what someone is feeling when they're in a controlled and controlling environment. So I am very happy that Michelle now gets to feel, and she gets to be herself, and she gets to be happy when she wants and to whatever degree she wants, and she gets to be sad, and she gets to be a whole variety of other things that are aligned with her and her mind and her experience and her reactions. And it's important for anyone listening out there that if you are demonized for having a reaction that comes up naturally in you, and you're told that it's not natural, that it's from some other source, think, why is it that I'm being told to demonize this? Why am I being told to somehow diagnose this in a negative way? How does it impact the person who's trying to control me? How does it threaten the person who's trying to control me? Because that's at the root of it. And that's where you can go, as opposed to, what's wrong with me that I'm feeling it or not feeling it? Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.